Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome, everyone, on Take Human Action PA, episode 49. I'm Calvin, I'm your host, and we've got Autumn's back. How are you doing, Autumn?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for having me back. I'm really excited to talk to Keith tonight.
Yeah. I'm glad to have you, too. I was going to say who the guest was in a minute, but...
Sorry.
Spoiled it a little bit for me. That's all right. I'm sure anyone who's read the episode description by now probably knows who it is. Regardless, thanks everyone for listening. We're episode 48 now. It's crazy. We're getting close to 50. So that's awesome. It's been really fun to do it so far, and I'm glad to have all the guests and co-hosts that have been helping out along the way, and all of the listeners as well. So thank you all very much for helping make the show what it is. Any comment on that, Autumn?
No, I think it's great. I really like Calvin. Thank God you're holding the fort down, really, and bringing us from the caucus in to co-host with you once in a while. It's especially nice. I don't know since we already let the cat out of the bag. Sorry. Keith is one of our guests this week that, you know, a lot of times when we have guests, we've got kind of people clamoring that want to, oh, I love that person. I want to be on and talk to them. Sometimes not everybody who wants to be on gets to be on. But I do want to definitely say that there were others who wanted to be there, but had scheduling conflicts. So I lucked out.
Yeah, that definitely applies in this case for sure. Yeah. But that's all right. We will press forward with what we have. And if anyone wants to drop questions in the chat, please do so.
And actually,
we'll bring on our guest.
I was just going to say, if you think if there's anybody out there listening who wants to be a co-host, start off by joining the caucus.
That is a great way to do so. So on that note, I'll bring on our guest now. He is managing editor at the Libertarian Institute, host of the Don't Tread on Anyone podcast, and editor of the Voluntarist Handbook, a collection of essays, excerpts, and quotes. On that note, let's bring on Keith Knight. How are you doing, Keith?
I am doing so well since you got the bio completely correct, 100% accuracy. It's amazing how often people screw that up. I appreciate you pimping the book just because this was like 10 years in the making. It is 50 essays and articles, sections of books that I came across that took me from being a progressive to being a libertarian. So it is, I would always think of, well, if I mention 50 books and 50 speeches that people should watch, they're not going to do any of them. They're going to be drinking out of a fire hose. But instead, if I say, look, there's one book. I spent 10 years putting it together. Here is one book to introduce you to our ideas. It was the Voluntarist Handbook. You don't even have to pay for it. If you go to libertarianinstitute.org, you can download a free PDF.
Yeah, I was looking at the contents and I was happy to see some as entries that I had read before and that definitely left the mark on me, and some that I had not. So I'll definitely be adding that to my list and looking forward to reading through it.
Awesome, man. Hope you enjoy it.
Thank you. So on that note, I'm sure you weren't born the Keith Knight you are now. So tell us how you got interested in these topics and how you got to your current position that you're at the Libertarian Institute and all the other things that you're doing.
So originally I had been a Democrat because I thought that, well, there's people who want to give you stuff, the Democrats, healthcare, housing, retirement plans, education, very nice people. And then these Republicans who more or less are either dupes of the 1% or just terrible racist sexists who don't want anyone to have basically anything. Even if you work for it, they'll still gripe that, well, you didn't do it the right way, no matter what. So clearly, I was just a Democrat. I couldn't see any alternative. There's the good people and the bad people. It seemed like what made government unique is it's the one organization in society which allows people to come together and cooperate, engage in discussions, referred to as democratic deliberation, and this allows them to achieve consensus, whereas the private sector is this dog-eat-dog sort of everyone trying to always get one up on each other mentality. So I was a big government advocate for some time. Little did I realize someone named Henry Hazlitt was out there who really tries to make the case in a book, Economics in One Lesson, that we are constantly cooperating in the private sector. So even if you're just alone on your computer watching videos, you probably didn't make the computer. You probably don't generate your electricity. You don't have your own internet supply. You're using a keyboard that was made by someone else. You're only alive because other people grew food that you exchanged money for. You're enjoying light, which someone else invented. You're constantly engaged in cooperation in the marketplace. So once I stopped looking at the marketplace as a uniquely dog-eat-dog world, whereas, I mean, of course, the politicians who are always competing for higher positions within the state, that's more dog-eat-dog than anything we see in the voluntary sector. So it turns out that what makes government unique is not the fact that people come together. In fact, it is the great source of division in many societies. And the private sector is actually an example of people coming together and achieving their aims voluntarily. The thing that really got me to see this clearly was Glenn Beck's show. I was watching and he was making sort of the cost-benefit analysis argument for the Affordable Care Act at the time and said, well, there's a lot of economic arguments, but these can be temporary and circumstances can change. What makes this law uniquely bad is that it forces someone to purchase health insurance, whether they want to or not. Even if you should purchase health insurance, it's a lot of things you should do: eat vegetables, exercise, read, be a nice person. Should the state be in charge of forcing you to do it with the threat of jailing you if you don't comply? And I said, you know what, if that's part of the Affordable Care Act, then I am not going to support it anymore, even though I was still a huge Obama supporter. It took me many, many years to realize that this is the same exact argument we can apply to state schools, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, food stamps, and the military. So really, I just stopped having double standards for the state, and I became a libertarian slowly but surely. I remember being a Romney supporter because Obama had let me down, and so we all went to the Republican presidential debates in Phoenix, Arizona, and one of the questions that they asked was, you get there, and of course, because it's free is another word for unavailable, because everyone who gets there way early takes up space, and so we ended up watching it outside on a big screen. And one of the questions was, describe yourself in one word. And Newt Gingrich hilariously says, cheerful. Haha. And then everyone goes on. And Ron Paul said, consistent. And I said, well, isn't that interesting that a lot of people didn't seem to take that as a point of pride in their philosophy? looked into Ron Paul a little. He had recommended the book, The Law by Frederick Bastiat. And then I just stopped having double standards for the state. Took a long time, but I got there.
Wow. You definitely went all over the place in terms of the political views in a short amount of time. But yeah, it makes so much more sense once you realize, you know, the double standards are, it's just crazy. Like when you think about it on a deeper level, like, you know, I support this idea for, you know, social issues and that idea for economics. You know, it's just at a certain point, I don't know why most people don't think of it that way. I guess that's just how our brains are wired, but I don't know. I just have a hard time understanding it. What do you think on them?
No, I find the best way to drive home most of the points of libertarian philosophy to somebody who's completely unfamiliar is to start to tell stories that draw parallels from, well, you think it's okay for the government to do this. Let's redress the situation as if it was individuals. And, yeah. And a lot of times open eyes. Yeah.
That is a good point.
You know, I would like to ask just a fun little question that we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but so Keith, like going back before you were even old enough to start thinking about politics, what did you think you wanted to be when you grew up? Because I'll bet it's not where you're at now.
I wanted to be a quarterback for the Atlanta Falcons.
Oh, there you go.
I had a blast playing football and I was always a quarterback.
Really? Oh, very cool.
Oh, that's fun.
Not a big surprise though that you were the thinker on the team. So interesting to hear. Yeah.
Very nice of you. Thanks.
Yeah, I bet. Speaking of hard work, you went to what, 3 of the Take Human Action Tour events?
Yeah, I was at New York, Chicago, and Nashville. I thought the events were all great. All the speakers were very engaging. Maj Toure, I thought, was really impressive. He basically all 3 times got up and started with the idea that, like, look, we're not good at marketing. We need to get better at marketing. Let's just go around and ask questions and have more or less a conversation about things. And he just did a terrific job. Heard there were some fireworks in Austin. I still got to watch that video with Maj.
Oh, yeah.
But Maj was terrific. It was nice seeing Dave and Tom. Clint Russell was in Nashville. And the hotels were real nice. All the people were very polite. Really no issues at the events. Definitely recommend them. If there's any more in the future, can't recommend them highly enough.
Yeah. Well, they did the pilot event last year too, so I have a feeling there'll be more coming up.
I hope so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, was anyone else at as many events as you were? I think you were the only one who did 3.
I'm not sure. I'd have to look at the
list. Well, either way, thank you very much for coming out. I mean, I know your talk definitely had an impact on us and the people in New York, and I'm sure at the other locations as well. So thanks for doing the work.
Of course.
Yeah. And one of the topics that certainly was a bit of a standout, and I know you've talked about this before in your podcast as well. I'll have to throw in a link for that in the show description. But you referenced the Pulse nightclub and how that there's a little more to it than initially meets the eye, or at least as far as, you know, what the politicians were using as their talking points. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and how you tied it in with your talk that you gave?
So the premise of my talk was the concept that, well, a lot of us are familiar with war is the health of the state, meaning that in a time of war, when there's an external enemy, governments are able to get away with violations of people's rights and liberties and taxes that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get away with. When people are feeling a little more secure, they're open to being skeptical, but a large external enemy allows the state to grow rapidly. What I attempted to do was take this idea, which was actually originated by Stefan Molyneux, where he says it's actually the state is the health of war. And there's a number of reasons behind this. Initially, the concept of having a central bank, the ability for the state to have a monopoly on the money supply, means that they're more likely to fund things that people don't find value in. and the concept of taxation, where they're able to gather funds against people's will in order to fund things that people may or may not support. Most countries have a selective service, even if it's not enacted. In America, all men ages 18 to 26 still have to register for forced military service. So when you have people who, whether they want to or not, have to go to war, well, then you're more likely to engage in something when people can't voluntarily opt out. You also have a system of compulsory education. No other organization has the right to force people to fund and attend their schools. This makes the average person much more sympathetic to the state and likely to believe their lies in going into wars. And then finally, the legal double standard, which is where governments have this capacity to commit murder under the guise of foreign policy. And no one even considers whether or not Biden, Trump, or Obama, or Bush should really be taken away in handcuffs, whether it's Fox News or MSNBC. They never really address that issue. So because of those reasons, the state is the health of war, and wars are much likely to occur in a lot of situations than they would otherwise be if we'd had private security, which is why hopefully we will move to a sort of privatized the security realm. The reason this matters is because with regard to the war on terror, it's often seen that, well, America, when we're sort of isolationist and we pull ourselves back, bad things happen. So the problem is we don't have a big state protecting us, and terrorism is allowed to thrive. Here is the reality of the situation. On June 12th, 2016, I have the quote in front of me, Omar Mateen went into the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, murdered 49 people, injured 53, and held the survivors hostage. And he called 911. And on this 911 call, we actually have a transcript of it. Here are a number of excerpts from the things he said. "You have to tell America to stop bombing Syria and Iraq. They are killing a lot of innocent people. What am I to do here when my people are getting killed over there? You get what I'm saying? You need to stop the U.S. airstrikes. Tell the U.S. government stop the bombing. They are killing too many children. They are killing too many women, okay? I feel the pain of the people getting killed in Syria and Iraq. They need to stop bombing Syria and Iraq. The U.S. is collaborating with Russia, and they are killing innocent women and children, okay? The airstrikes need to stop and stop collaborating with Russia, okay? You see? Now you feel how it is." So after this obvious motive was blowback terrorism for the actions of the government being in existence and committing atrocities in the first place, you can look at the Council on Foreign Relations. This happened in June of 2016, the year 2016. The U.S. dropped 12,192 bombs on Syria and 12,095 bombs on Iraq. So he wasn't just a paranoid guy. This was actually a case of blowback terrorism. So here is how Barack Obama actually sold the incident to the public. He said, "This was an attack on the LGBT community. Americans were targeted because we're a country that has learned to welcome everyone, no matter who you are or who you love, and hatred towards people because of sexual orientation, regardless of where it comes from, is a betrayal of what's best in us," completely gaslighting the public as to the reality of the murderer's motives. So Donald Trump, certainly the anti-establishment guy who's against the deep state, totally different party, hates Obama. He's going to give us the truth. Here's what Trump said on June 13th. "This is a very dark moment in American history. A radical Islamic terrorist targeted the nightclub, not only because he wanted to kill Americans, but in order to execute gay and lesbian citizens because of their sexual orientation. It's a strike at the heart and soul of who we are as a nation. It's an assault on the ability of free people to live their lives, love who they want, and express their identity." It's important because this is a lie that has been going on for about 20 years with regard to the idea that the war on terrorism is about a bunch of people who hate us for our freedom. Originally, it was George Bush who really set this lie in motion. On September 20th of 2001, George Bush said in a State of the Union, I'm sorry, it wasn't a state of, it was an address to Congress. He said, Americans are asking, why do they hate us? They hate what they see in this chamber, a democratically elected government. Their leaders are self-appointed. They hate our freedoms, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote and assemble and disagree with each other. Here's what bin Laden actually said in a book titled Tactical Recommendations. Then the fighters realized that the gang in the White House could not see things clearly, and that idiot they obey was claiming we envied their lifestyle, when the truth, which this pharaoh would like to hide, is that we are attacking them because of their injustice toward the Muslim world, and especially Palestine and Iraq, as well as their occupation of the land of the two sanctuaries. So the war on terror is the result of big government murdering civilians, and citizens have to bear the cost of the blowback. Remember, the social contract idea is that, look, you have to obey government, and yes, they get to tax you and no one else does, but in exchange, you get security. But if you don't pay, if you don't hold up your end of the social contract, you go to jail and they shoot you if you resist. If they don't hold up their end of the deal, if they don't keep you safe, well, they get more money and more power and never apologize, and then get on stage and have the presidential candidates lie about the reality of the situation, about what really is a threat to people's freedoms. Very upset about alleged Chinese spy balloons as the IRS takes 30% of our income and schools are trying to brainwash kids with a drag queen story hour. So the enemy is within the gates, as it always has been. Great threat to our freedoms is not radical Islam or Russia or China. It is the IRS, the Federal Reserve, and the politicians who claim the right to rule us. The war on terror is a perfect example of this.
Wow.
I got a question. So, Keith, how long did it take, if you know, for the real story about the Pulse nightclub killing to come out, for that transcript to be?
Well, probably like a year or two once the media really, the independent media started really circulating the 911 phone call. I came across this from Glenn Greenwald's research. Probably, gosh, it had to have been a few years after it happened, because I heard about it and I just go, well, I'm not buying that it's an LGBT hate crime, because every other one that I look into is fake. So I'm just going to ignore this one. It's like every time I get a DM on Twitter, hi, I'm new to Twitter. You're really attractive. Here's my WhatsApp. I really think we're going to be great together. Hot Asian woman, one follower, account created one day ago. You just know that that's a scam. So you just delete it and you don't even consider the fact that it's real. Same with all these terrorist events and all these murders. If on the off chance there is one that happens to be accurate, it still is not worth the opportunity cost of looking into every single one. So for me, it was Glenn Greenwald specifically. I don't remember how long after, but of course, people like Scott Horton were on this immediately, and he did great work on it. And I remember I just saw the headline and I go, oh, Pulse is based on a lie too. Good for Scott. Keep up the good work. But like years before him and I ever spoke in person.
Yeah, it's crazy how it's all tied together. And before you talked about it, I might have heard it like once in passing, but I think that was the first time I really heard it broken down like that. And it just makes so much more sense.
You know what? Credit to, there was a local news report out of Florida, and they had like a 5-second interview with one of the victims. And gosh, I gotta find this. And it was this, you know, cute little girl saying, you know, it was really scary. He had said he was mad that America was bombing his country. And then it cuts right to the other reporter. And whoever put that in is an absolute hero, because they did not have to do that. And it was they clearly could have just gone on with the narrative. But I found one local news reporter that actually gave an excerpt of a correct interpretation from one of the victims. But there's a reason we haven't heard about those victims too much.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good transition point to mistrust in the media in general. Now there's been some more activity on that front recently. I know, Autumn, there was something you wanted to bring up along those lines.
Yeah, so I heard somebody, it was Dan Smots actually today. I listened to his most recent episode and the System is Down podcast. So I heard him say for the first time that someone with the Pentagon came out and made a comment that the country is a much safer place now with Tucker Carlson off the air. Okay, so whether you have a specific comment on that, we can go for a little while on Tucker Carlson. But in general, the observation that I had was like I realize I'm doing these flip-flops. I got inception in my mind in perception of the news. And here it is. They're saying, oh, we're better off without Tucker Carlson. And that's reverse psychology. They actually want us to listen to him. He's controlled opposition. You can't trust him. So how often do you find yourself falling down those rabbit holes of like, if you hear it, then it's definitely the opposite? Or,
it's all about credibility. That was Johnny Cochran's great contribution to my intellectual reading, where he said, look, it's all about credibility. So whether you're going to a person or an institution, all you really have, even if you have a document and you're reading the document, documents are written by people. They could be lying. They could be mistaken. They could be misled. They could have a fundamental vision of the world that allows them to see things differently than other people do. So it's all about credibility when it comes to those things. So Tucker Carlson's credibility when it comes to humility, I think, is probably his greatest asset, where he is not only, a little skeptical of Iraq and Syria. He explicitly says, I was totally wrong about Iraq. We'll do many segments on Syria. Even when it's not in the news, he'll bring it to the forefront. He'll do a number of things on Julian Assange. He'll try and expose the reality of the Ukraine situation. So I think Tucker Carlson is as good as they get when it comes to the mainstream media. Of course, guys like Max Blumenthal, Glenn Greenwald, Jimmy Dore, Scott Horton, I think these people are the best journalists. Matt Taibbi is another great source online for this. When it comes to his January 6th footage, it was so vitally important because it really put nails in the coffin on the two big events that people would focus on. They'd say January 6th was an insurrection. Okay, that's vague. The two things they would say is, well, there was a police officer beat to death with a fire hydrant. And then they just stopped reporting on it after they had said that originally. The guy's name is Brian Sicknick. He had died a few days after the event. I believe it was as a result of a stroke. But either way, the autopsy did not say blunt force trauma as a cause or result of fire extinguisher from the January 6ers. Okay, so that was the first one. The reason that Tucker's footage was so important is because he shows Sicknick walking around all throughout the day. So you don't actually see this fake attack that they claim happened. At least poor Jesse Smollett staged his attack and had people hit him. This guy Sicknick was not hit at all. Second thing was the QAnon shaman. That, this guy ran in, was, calling the shots and maybe threatening people and trying to take over the White House. And it turns out he was actually being escorted by multiple police officers who were constantly, up to 9 officers at one point or another, were in, within arm's reach of him. And they could have arrested him. None of these people, were brandishing weapons. There's one image of a guy with, zip ties. You can't call this an insurrection. So, Tucker did a great job at really refuting the media narrative on January 6th that it was just a riot by people who were unhappy that, that they had put so much hope in Trump and Trump didn't give them anything they wanted. So they were just looking for someone to blame. But that is the nature of the state. People constantly reaping benefits at the expense of everyone else, regardless of who is sitting on the throne at the time. Look at how upset Trump is with everything that's going on now. You would think that Trump has never been in politics before. He looks at everything like it's in shambles. It's like, well, you were there for 4 years. You didn't drain the swamp at all. You gave us John Bolton. You didn't fire Fauci. You went soft on the media compared to how you really could have gone. So Yeah, when it comes to Tucker, I think the media definitely lost the best person there is. But it's not like he's going away. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to see what Tucker does next.
Yeah, same. I can't imagine he's not going to go independent, right? I think the one thing on the list that has me like skeptical about Tucker Carlson, do you have any information on his dad? I only did a little bit of research to double check what I had heard somebody say, Dick Carlson. So he was a...
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
A prominent figure in some state-sponsored media in his day, including things that were broadcast into Cuba. So really interesting, worth a little peek to keep your mind flip-flopping on whether he's a good guy or a baddie.
Yeah, and that's why it's important to not get totally married to personalities. You have to be willing to throw people under the bus at some point. But dear God, I don't want to be held responsible for anything my dad ever did. So that for me is not enough to throw Tucker under the bus after, you know, all the great contributions that he's given us.
It could be his form of rebellion. You never know.
Could be.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole nother train of thought. But you know, let's say that at least for the near future, Tucker departs from media. So we have like the media that we have now, but without Tucker. Is that just going to send any remaining trust and viewership of what's left of the corporate press in free fall? Like, what are your predictions?
God, I certainly hope so. Just because, I mean, the only reason that I would ever watch Fox is to watch either Tucker's Fox show or his Fox Nation show, where there's like a wooden background. He's had Curtis Yarvin on there, to my surprise. He's had Glenn Lowry, and they get into like long 1 hour conversations on those. But I can't imagine it increases the credibility at all. People who are already skeptical are saying, well, that's just it. I'm done with Fox. I'm going to One America News, which is really a terrific news outlet. Comparatively, it's such a step up from Newsmax and Fox, let alone CNN and MSNBC. But yeah, I certainly hope Fox and CNN and MSNBC tank, because they're just outrage mobs that are talking about one or two stories. I mean, Fox was on at the gym today, and it was just a reel of one tranny beating up someone. And I'm like, look, this is sickening and evil, but I feel like I'm getting harassed at some point. Like, the term violent harassment, I think we need to start having, just as sexual harassment would be unwanted sexual advances, unwanted violent advances where people are like, children were murdered today and these kids are dead and their parents are crying and there was another murder of children today. All these sick motherfuckers always trying to say the next thing to get people outraged. And the solution always is, oh, the mass murdering government needs more power, to the surprise of no one. They control the goddamn schooling system, and then they grow up to believe that this group should have total supremacy over everyone else. So, yeah, I hope the media basically suffers and burns to the ground, and only Joe Rogan and Dave Smith and Matt Taibbi are left standing.
Yeah, well, you kind of dig into my next question there. So I'll just see if you have anything else to add. Other than Libertarian Institute and antiwar.com, where do you go to for your news?
Well, I will reiterate the Libertarian Institute. one of the great things is we try and bring up things that not only give you an economic perspective, a historical perspective, but we also try to stay on top of current events. So even though current events come and go, we still have a news section where we try to lead by example and talk about things that are actually vitally important and refute the deep state narrative. Antiwar.com, as you mentioned, is vitally important. I run mostly the blog at the Libertarian Institute, and that is the result of me reading books and in, you know, a 150-page book like Economy, Society, and History that few people are willing to sit down and read. If I find one or two quotes, I will put those on the blog. So the opportunity cost that people are saving by going to libertarianinstitute.org, checking out the blog, checking out the podcasts, it will save you so much time as far as reading books, reading articles, and going into, in-depth research rabbit holes. Another place that I like is the Council on Foreign Relations. They really are the steel man for the establishment. So if you want to hear, it's one thing to say, well, yeah, the CNN writers are idiots. But when I read CFR.org, I say, okay, here is, you know, guys like Richard Haass really making the best case they can for funding Ukraine and provoking, not necessarily provoking Russia at this point. Originally, it looked like provoking Russia was the intention through NATO expansion. It looks much more now like the goal is to weaken Russia, much like they did in the late 1970s under Jimmy Carter, by pulling them into Afghanistan and attempting to bleed the Soviets dry. The goal here is to pull Russia into Ukraine, bleed them dry, ruin global credibility, and hopes of making any provocations with China have less power so China can't lean on Russia if China ever tries to enforce claims on Taiwan or blockade Taiwan. So that's not exactly something you would get on NBC or anywhere else. So really, the two places that I look at are libertarianinstitute.org and CFR.org. Other than that, when I usually will follow people on Twitter who, and usually once they've developed a good reputation of finding stories, then those are the people I'll click on. People on the left, like Caitlin Johnstone and Michael Tracy, always have terrific things. Matt Taibbi's Twitter is really good. Glenn Greenwald, Jimmy Dore, all of those people I really like. I definitely think that there should be a libertarian progressive alliance, because the progressives could have virtually everything they claim they want so long as they don't force people to chip in through a concept of taxation. And they allow people to engage in voluntary, mutually beneficial contracts between consenting adults. So again, it's so big, yet so small, of a gap between us and the conservatives and the progressives. So mainly, I would say Twitter, Libertarian Institute, and CFR.org is where I get most of my information.
Yeah, those are excellent suggestions. Thank you, Keith. And since you mentioned the Progressive Libertarian Alliance, I can't not mention Rage Against the War Machine, which is still ongoing. They had their big rally in D.C. back in February, but more projects are upcoming. I'm not sure I can announce them yet, so I won't say what they are. But I will say, go back to episode 38 of this show. We did a roundtable with, you know, people from the Mises Caucus and people from the People's Party and the other groups that partnered with the Rage Against the War Machine to do a recap of the rally and talking about where we're going from here. So definitely go back and watch that episode. It was a good one, and it was a good event overall. So Autumn, any commentary on any of that?
I think I'm curious what you just said about the new perspective on what we might be pulling with Russia. That's news to me. And I totally get what you're saying, and it makes perfect sense. Is there anything else that's coming up in the media that you're keeping an eye on, that you're watching for shifts or pivots in narratives that are going on, that you think we should, you know, I don't want to wait 2 more years to find out about, you know, I literally learned about Pulse just this year. So what am I maybe gonna miss if I'm not keeping a close eye on things?
So the main thing that is not really circulating anymore, but the concept of inflation is finally accurately getting talked about. Credit to the Daily Wire for having Peter Schiff on their podcast recently, where the media will constantly say inflation is hitting stores and prices are going up. And the implication is that inflation is when prices go up. Notice that this doesn't differentiate between when there's an increase in the money supply and each dollar is worth less than it otherwise would have been, and when there's a change in supply and demand of goods or services. So the main thing is to know that inflation is the result of an increase in the money supply. Second thing is parents are getting more pissed off every day about the schools that they are forced to fund with the threat of their houses being seized in places like Arizona. You don't pay your property taxes that go to the school. Well, they confiscate your house and you're homeless. And then they say, well, can't believe there's a homeless problem. I guess we need to have another committee on this and raise taxes and increase zoning regulations. So when it comes to things like school choice, I think that is going to just eventually be so beneficial that they're either going to fight it a lot less, or their fights against it are going to be become so pathetic that people like Randy Weingartner, head of the American Federation Teachers Union, she looks more ridiculous every day. We never advocated for closing down schools. We advocated common sense policies as they explicitly advocated, you know, schools should be closed and everything should be done over Zoom. The good thing about schools closing and things done over Zoom is many people, Joe Rogan included, finally saw the great amount of time that the education system wastes, and all of the busy work and the great opportunity cost in the lives of children, where it's like, all right, you were just there, you know, 6-7 hours, 5 days a week. You better have learned a ton of stuff. Because when I sit down, when you walk into an LPMC event and sit down for 5 minutes, if you don't have a notepad, you're going to miss all the stuff that that you could have learned. But with this, it's like, they don't face any competition. They face very little discipline. They assume, okay, I'm entitled to people's time. Now let's work around me. Whereas in the voluntary sector, it's the complete opposite. So we're going to expect to see costs of education rise and quality of education continue to fall, and people hopefully looking more towards school choice. So those are the big ones. What is inflation? Why people want school choice? And why are schools bad in the first place? And provoking a third world war over Taiwan. It's important just because the First World War was not necessarily empires going to war with each other. It actually started with the Austro-Hungarian Empire going to war over Serbia because they had the blank check from Kaiser Wilhelm of the German government that they would back Serbia, that they would back Austria if Russia came in on behalf of Serbia. So today, when we say, oh yeah, we're going to back Ukraine, what that means is the politicians in Ukraine who are there as the result of an American-backed coup in 2014, essentially they determine American foreign policy. If they want to get tough on Russia, America's going to have to go to war with a nuclear power. And if we give a war guarantee to Taiwan, the people of Taiwan will suffer. In the Second World War, idiots were always saying, well, never Neville Chamberlain's a name you give someone when they quit and they appease. And then they tell us we always have to appease our government whenever they do something evil and you can never resist them. whatever. It was actually Neville Chamberlain on September 3rd, 1939, who declared war against Germany, not because Germany invaded Britain, but because they had given Poland a war guarantee only against Germany, because the Soviets invaded 2 weeks later and the British never declared war on the Soviet Union. So by claiming we're going to protect the people of Serbia, or we're going to protect the people of Belgium in the First World War, the people of Serbia and Belgium and Austria and Germany all suffered because governments were so kind to give out war guarantees. Not sure if you heard, but in the Second World War, the Poles actually not only suffered during the Second World War, they ended the war under Soviet occupation of the entire country. Churchill actually said to Stalin at a meeting in Yalta, he said, "We declared war for Polish independence. Millions of Poles have died. That didn't work out. Can we at least have free elections in Poland?" And Stalin said, "Free elections like in British occupied Egypt." And the Poles did not see free elections as a result of Britain kindly declaring war on their behalf. So the U.S. regime, the State Department, is not doing anyone any favors when they say, "We're going to support the Ukrainians." What they mean is they're going to pick a guy, call him the president, and say that he gets all this money. They very well could have just said, "Well, the president is Viktor Yanukovych in 2014, and they wouldn't have supported the Maidan revolutions that took place in Ukraine. So that's why it's so important. It's not that, America is going to declare war on Russia immediately. It's going to happen in Ukraine is going to be the catalyst. It's not going to directly be America goes into Beijing. It's going to be Taiwan. And just as the Americans did not want the Soviets to have Soviet missiles 90 miles off their border in Cuba, the Chinese are not going to allow the U.S. to have all this military buildup 80 miles off their shore in Taiwan. So that's why it's so dangerous. And that's why it really is a homicide suicide. I can't think of that expression. It's this murder suicide pact that they apparently have going on. Because if you remember, the first time NATO, the North American Treaty Organization, a military alliance, not just people trading and being on good terms with each other, aggression against one state, all states then have to declare war. It's referred to as Article 5. The first time they ever did this was in 2001 after September 11th. They never did it against the Soviets. And that gave us a 20-year war against the Taliban, where thousands of lives were lost, tens of thousands of people wounded, kids watching their parents get their limbs blown off, children being murdered, trillions of dollars, tons of property destruction and economic effects, sanctions afterwards, which starved civilians. And after all that, the Taliban took over in 11 days against the installed regime that the U.S. tried to put up. So that's NATO's record. First time they went for it, absolute catastrophe. And that's another good war they're always bragging about. Well, Afghanistan was the good one. Iraq might have been a mistake. They were both terrible wars. In fact, there is an article from The Guardian in October of 2001, and it's titled "Bush Rejects Taliban Offer." And this was the Taliban actually offering to hand over Osama bin Laden, not because the Taliban are a bunch of good guys. They're a bunch of non-aggression principle violators like every other regime, and they're much worse domestically than most. However, it wasn't in their interest to have the U.S. come in and start, you know, making the country worse than it otherwise would have been for them. You want a nice, prosperous place to hopefully rule over, you know, to some point. And Bush actually rejected this offer that they would hand Osama bin Laden over to any third country. So that basically means we're not giving him to Britain, we're not giving him to Israel, and we're not sending him to America. We'll send him to any third country, and that country will have him on a plane to Maryland probably in no time. They could have gotten all the information out of bin Laden. Bush actually mentions this in a book he claims to have written titled Decision Points, where he says, "We knew that giving them the offer would show their defiance and allow the world to rally around our cause." So they never wanted bin Laden in the first place. It was always beneficial to have the boogeyman out there to justify further war expansion. So, all of these wars, even the best ones, First World War, Second World War, the War on Terror, all absolute atrocities. And it's important because people will say, well, you support the free market. Don't you know about child labor? As if child labor only existed in free market societies. Of course, they consisted in all of them. But these people who say, I'm for social justice and I support government, but not the wars that they commit. Well, the wars are a pretty big, massive thing. So it's the equivalent of saying in 1923, I support the Ku Klux Klan. They should get more money and more power, but then they shouldn't be racist after that. It's literally like saying, I want to give the government a ton of money and a ton of power, but I'm against the wars. To hold both of those positions is to lie in complete contradiction. And once people start feeling the guilt and uneasiness and insecurity about the atrocities of these regimes, maybe the average person, you're always going to get the Bolsheviks who and the National Socialists who are never just going to concede an inch. But maybe that is what it's going to take. If logic doesn't take it, maybe it's just wearing them down with guilt for all the atrocities of this organization that they so often proudly pledge their allegiance to and thank people for serving.
Isn't it funny how it can all be cured with consistency?
So often.
Yeah. And one thing that just occurred to me in what you were saying is if memory serves, when Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany gave the blank check to Austria-Hungary to take whatever action they deemed necessary about Serbia, he went off on a cruise and kind of forgot about it, didn't think anything would really come of it. But if you think about it, with Biden's self-awareness, he's basically like in a cruise in his head 24/7. So it's like 10 times worse.
Kaiser Wilhelm on a cruise in 1914 is still more aware of current events than Biden in the Situation Room.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Quite the analogy, Calvin. You get the gold star tonight.
Yeah, so that makes it even more scary. We'll try not to dwell on that too much, but I'm probably going to bring that up again. All right, I do want to get to the last subject, though, before we run out of time. So bringing it back to making politics decentralized, which is what I titled the episode. So we talked about a lot of important concepts in the show so far, and you know, we talked a little bit about this when we were conversing at the convention, or excuse me, the Take Human Action Tour event as well. So how can we take these concepts and, you know, have our candidates talk about it while they're on the campaign trail, or bring it to, you know, the local level in some sort of policy form if possible? Like, what can we do here?
You know, I actually had an example of this in the speech that I gave. All right. So here's a roundabout way that I'll answer that. This woman, Skylar Baker Jordanson, writes for The Independent, and she wrote an article titled, I went to a right-wing libertarian conference as a socialist. I was pleasantly surprised by what I found. And she says, we are libertarians because we love liberty and hate injustice, comedian Dave Smith said in remarks that opening night. The reason we are libertarians is because governments destroy innocent people's lives, and we hate that. Smith went on to speak against the Patriot Act and imperialist wars, such as Iraq and Afghanistan, and in favor of civil liberties, the exact three issues which motivated me to get involved in left-leaning politics in the early 2000s. So I think the best way that we can motivate local candidates is recognize that it's people like Dave Smith who really make libertarianism attractive to the masses. We could have, we've had, you know, Frederick Bastiat's The Law since 1850. Lysander Spooner rejected the entire idea of constitutionalism, monarchy, government in and of itself. In, I think, 1867, he wrote No Treason. The Constitution of No Authority. So if we have all these arguments until they become popular by people who see the role that people like Dave Smith play in the pop culture, then local candidates can popularly use those ideas to attract people who otherwise would have easily dismissed them. Larry Sharp made this point, actually, in the following morning after the New York event. He had said, well, people might say, you know, I got 2% of the vote. Who am I to say anything? I'm obviously not governor of New York, even though I ran. So what evidence do I have that my strategy or my advice should be taken seriously? And he says, well, what we can do is compare. We can take the candidate who won governor of New York, I can't remember who it was, and compare what they said on the campaign trail to what they said in their acceptance speech and see what changed as a cause or result of there being a third party candidate who was at least nudging them one way or another. And he pointed to a number of examples where the winning candidate actually used his platform in her acceptance speech. Not because she said, I'm slowly becoming a libertarian and these guys are right and they have great ideas. She just realized that, well, there is a lot of heat behind this. So I'm going to, I see this big parade. I'm just going to step in front of it. At some point, it just becomes profitable once these ideas are popular enough for politicians to embrace them. And then, and they're never going to give us credit. So do not hold out for when are they going to admit they're wrong? Never. It's always going to be some roundabout way. So when it comes to that, we basically need to build golden bridges for these people to retreat across. Hey, you're a progressive. You care about equality and justice. The most unequal thing you could have in a society is one group with the recognized right to initiate violence against peaceful people. And if you're a conservative, you're for civilization and against barbarism. There's nothing more barbaric than the concept that some people get to rule over others. And when they don't blindly obey these tyrants, well, we get to cage them and shoot them if they resist. That's extremely anti-family. And it basically stops people from engaging in things they consistently believe in. If I want to abide by a concept, thou shall not murder, because I'm part of the Catholic Church. Well, if I'm chipping into a mass murdering organization called government, it's going to be hard for me to consistently live the Catholic or Mormon or Protestant life that I'd like to. So by showing people that it's their own ideology that they can take consistently and they don't have to throw out everything else, they just have to change one tiny aspect of it. On top of making these ideas popular by taking lessons we've learned from people like Dave Smith, I think local candidates can do a great job going forward if they embrace those ideas. But then again, I've never won local candidacy, so maybe I'm full of shit and you should listen to someone else.
I think it's really important what you called out there. And this is something that we've been having some conversations. I was working door knocking with Ben Heckman a few weeks ago, and we were talking about that it can become tiring when you don't have big wins, right? But that's the nature of a decentralized process, is that there's a lot of little wins, like what you described that Larry talked to us about, that are really easy to miss. And we have to work a little harder maybe at pointing them out for each other.
Awesome. Yes. Thank you guys so much for all the work you do with LPMC. Great organization. I am not officially part of it. I'm just there on my free time, separate from my 501c3, the Libertarian Institute. Right. Not representing them, but that is who I work for.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Keith. Don't forget to follow him on Twitter. You know, follow the Libertarian Institute and follow everything else that he's doing. Check out his podcast, but I'm kind of stealing it, the thunder on your plugs a little bit. But yeah, thanks again for everything that you do also, and go ahead and give your plugs.
If I could plug one thing, I think it would be the Voluntarist Handbook. If people want to check that out, they can go to my Odyssey, YouTube, Spotify accounts and check out excerpts from the Voluntarist Handbook, or go to libertarianinstitute.org for a free PDF. That is probably the one thing that I think is so vitally important. 318 pages. Like I said, the PDF is free, and the book is summarized in the first two introduction pages and the last two afterward pages. So in one night, you can get the overall summary of what I'm getting at here to see if it's worth your time.
Yeah, I did include the exact link through the Libertarian Institute website to get the book in the episode description. So that's an easy way to get it for anyone listening here. So thank you again, Keith. Any last words on him before we sign off?
Nope. Let's get Keith to his next obligation. I know he's got one right now.
All right.
Thanks so much, guys. It's been a pleasure. Take care.
Bye.
All right, Autumn. That was a good episode. I really enjoyed that. Keith's always a riot.
Yeah. Yeah, I was still a little more rambly with my question, but I think it worked.
Yeah, it worked out. Yeah, so next week, it's looking like we're going to have Mike Meharry on. So that's another person who made it, the rounds at the Take You in Action Tour. He at least went to two of those events. He's been doing the work on that too.
Yeah, I listened to the live stream of Chicago, I think it was, where he was.
So he was there too?
It might not have been Chicago, but whichever one was the other that he was at, I was live streaming.
Yeah, I think it was Austin.
Yeah, I got to catch it. He's great. Okay. I love him.
Yeah, right on. So he'll be on next week. I believe we scheduled that one for 6 o'clock. So not Eastern time. So not 9 o'clock. Catch that one at 6 o'clock. So that'll be coming next week. And then we've got BJ coming on for episode 50. He's going to give us a recap of primary day and talk about all of the candidates that we're going to have on. So excited for that also. Anything you want to mention before we sign off, Autumn?
Oh, just the fact that I didn't even realize we were still on the show. I thought that once we said goodbye to Keith, we were off. So you were just casual way that I talked to Calvin when I think we're just shooting the bull.
There you go. Now, I'll take us off now, but not quite yet. So until next time, everyone, don't forget to take human action. Bye.
Bye.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.